Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour on our new weekday, Fridays, instead of Thursdays. But, of course, all programs are archived, and listeners can either tune in live. Well, we're live right now, of course. Or they can listen archived. All PRN programs are archived for easy listening. My guest today, delighted always to have James Petras back. Jim is I'm going to change what I say about Jim. He's an expert in virtually all parts of the world. I always call Jim a Latin American expert, and that's true. That absolutely is true. I've got about 15 of his books on my shelf, and most of them are about Latin America, but he certainly covers virtually all other parts of the world, and his articles are very important. I guess, Jim, they can access your articles on your website just by Googling your name, I imagine. Isn't that so?
Yes, Steve. You can just hit James Petras website, and it'll come up.
I know, though, anybody can access my blog site by just Googling my last name. That's the way I go to it. Just Google Lendman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N. I think there probably aren't a lot of Petruses around, Jim, and there certainly are not a lot of Lendmans around. The only one in my locale in Chicago is, I believe, a funeral home.
Whatever. Well, let's hope you don't have to patronize that.
No, I'm not planning to anytime soon, hopefully. I think they're in southern Wisconsin. I don't know a thing about them. But anyway, issues of the day. Jim, there's so much going on. And, of course, what's making headlines right now is this outrageous filth, this anti-Muslim hate film. And I wrote about it and sent you an article I wrote this morning. It's pretty ugly stuff. Maybe you could comment on that.
Well, it's hard to tell what's behind all this. It's clear that one of the main beneficiaries is Israel because it arouses hostilities between Muslims and the U.S., and what Israel wants is to have the U.S. provoked into taking armed action. Unfortunately, it is sending the Marines in to Libya now, and it's strengthening its military patrols off the coast, which may be a way of buttressing a puppet regime which was put in power by the U.S. with the help of the terrorists, who paradoxically are the same people that the U.S. helped to overthrow Gaddafi, or they directed him to overthrow Gaddafi, and now they turn around and blow away the U.S. embassy. I guess that's what they call blowback. But I think the key issue here, Steve, in all of these uprisings in Yemen, in Libya, in Somalia, all through the Arab world, is the great frustration and disappointment in the Arab Spring. I can't imagine that it's all over a film. Let's go down the list here. Washington devastated Iraq with over a million people dead and several million displaced. Devastated Afghanistan, is devastating Syria, destroyed Libya, is involved in Somalia. All of these cases are cases where countries have been divided, destroyed, their economies are in shambles, and people are totally uprooted from their daily lives. Take Libya, for example, a very prosperous welfare state now that's overrun with fundamentalists, with clans, with U.S. puppets, mercenaries, etc., etc. Previously a very prosperous, stable country with all the different religions coexisting. And Washington goes in, the leading Air Force, destroying the country. And now, what do we have? We have people that are uprooted and with guns in their hands, and each one is trying to grab a piece of the action. And this is the product of the Bush, Obama, Clinton kind of regime change. And this is the fruits of it. Look, we're harvesting the fruits of a U.S. intervention.
Well, Jim, of course, the guns these people have in their hands are the guns that America and the other Western countries and their regional allies put in their hands. And I've read stuff that said before the Libya war began, and I absolutely call it Washington's war planned years ago, same thing in all the other trouble spots throughout the Middle East, the wars that we know about and the ones that are planned. I mean, this is Washington's planning behind it, and then they get other NATO countries to go along and Middle East allies, the usual suspects, the Saudis, the Qataris, and they get others, the Jordanians. Israel, of course, is in the middle of all of this stuff, either overtly or behind the scenes. They operate their own way. And I'm writing again on Netanyahu again today, Jim, for tomorrow. My goodness gracious. I mean, a guy, even the U.S. president can't get along with. Anyway, I'm very suspicious about this film. I, honest to God, I don't know. How could I know? But I, honest to God, suspect that Israel is behind the whole thing. And I suspect that part of the agenda is that Netanyahu is not too happy about Obama pulling the plug on the timeline that he prefers to attack Iran. I assume he wants to, although it's hard to separate his bluster from what he really means and what he really wants to do. Well, not so much what he wants to do, but what other people in Israel, other top officials, what they want. And my suspicion on that is that most of them want no part of a war with Iran. Just the Likudniks, the hardliners around him, they may want it, but the cooler heads know that this is absolute insanity to have a war with Iran. I mean, Israel could end up a destroyed country if they do it. You know, they could level each other. And well, you've written about this, and you know what the dangers are, and cooler heads in America know what the dangers are. But I suspect that he wants to get back at Obama. He prefers that Romney be elected in November, and he's trying to do something to get people mad at Obama. So I think some of this will rub off on Obama. Whether it'll last through November 6th, we'll have to wait and see. But I think right now this is having a negative effect on Obama, and we may see it in polls that come out before too long.
Well, I think it's clearly in the interest of Netanyahu to stir up hostility and arouse the Arab masses. But I think the underlying factors here are largely the product of U.S. Intervention in the region. You don't destroy a country and leave it in shambles and not expect that there's going to be major unrest. The U.S. government intervened in Egypt, made sure that the Mubarak military intelligence remained in place. They conned Morsi, this Islamic Brotherhood president, to coexist with the military. They're offering him $4 billion now to liberalize and privatize the economy and take away all the subsidies. So there's a lot of discontent building up in Egypt as a result, first, of the aborted democracy process, and now with these harsh economic measures. So Morsi is trying to distract attention to the film rather than face up to his becoming a client of Washington and the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. I think that plays a big role, using religion as a shield against his neoliberal policies. And the same thing goes in Yemen. You have a major uprising there that's not simply against the film, but the aborted uprising there. There's no democracy in Yemen. The U.S. intervened to make sure that the outgoing dictatorship was replaced by a new client. So there's a lot of resentment that's built up over the last year as a result of Washington becoming terribly involved in the area. And this revolt is not simply about a film. It's about getting the U.S. out of a region where it has flunkies ruling the people and against the will of the majority.
Jim, I absolutely agree. The film is a spark. You know, somebody lit
that. Yeah, I call it the trigger.
The trigger, absolutely. I mean, the issues are fundamental, and they're the ones that people are very, very angry about, and they should be. I mean, they have been pummeled year after year after year without end, and the reverberations cross borders and so on. And then you get a spark like this film that just ignites people. Well, you know, I think the people involved with this thing, and again, my suspicion is Israel, I think this is well known. I mean, you can get people riled up very, very easily by doing some of this stuff, and this film sure did it. But the film, you know, this film came out in July. The whole film, I think it had a different name. It opened in Los Angeles in a small theater. And I quoted from a Los Angeles Times article. I didn't mention the fact, I said it attracted little attention. It sure did attract little attention. On one showing, 10 people showed up. I didn't mention that in my article. I had so much else in it. But then it came out in an Arabic 13-minute trailer, timed for 9/11, and that was the spark that set things off. And it came out on YouTube, and it circulated widely, and people in the Middle East saw it, and so on and so forth. And we see it happening now. I mean, there are riots going on in one Muslim state after another in the Middle East, Sudan, Yemen. it goes on and on, Jim. I think even in occupied Palestine, there's stuff going on. And right across the region, I know Morocco for sure, from Morocco to Yemen to maybe Saudi Arabia, we haven't heard about yet, but people have a right to be angry, and they're certainly showing it.
Well, I think one also has to analyze the context in which that film was made. I think between Jewish Zionists and Christian Zionists, there's a whole milieu of hate Islam, Islamophobia, they call it, the psychiatrists, that includes some of the leading propagandists for Israel, like Pipes, Geller, and others. And then you have this character, Klein, who's part of a training Christian militia people from the far right. There's a whole milieu that is pretty respectable in the East Coast, in New York City. They had big protests against the building of a mosque. And this murderer in Norway was also inspired by the writings of Geller and Pipes. And the media don't play this up, the interaction between the extremists that actually carry out these crimes. This hate crime film was one. The other is the murderer of 68 people in Norway. He also was online with the Islamophobes in the United States, which, of course, after the fact, they disclaim, but they feed into the psychopathic behavior of people, and I think this is what results from it. We have here a whole ambience that has quite a bit of respectability that nurtures these kind of extremists, the extremist filmmaking, the extreme hatred of Muslims, the extreme violence against them. Let's not forget Homeland Security, under its previous director, was rounding up Muslims. The Supreme Court has ruled that it's all right for the FBI to carry out surveillance. And even though it's illegal, they said, well, to go into this illegal behavior would reveal national secrets, and therefore secrets take priority over the constitution and legality. There's a whole milieu here that's been cultivating this kind of behavior, and just to tie it to some screwball filmmaker would be anti-Islamist is, I think, limiting the causal chain here.
Oh, again, I agree, Jim. There's a lot going on, and of course, it's really been played up very big, I guess, across Europe, but certainly it's played up big in America. Headline stories, the newspapers, television, and so on. And they, as usual, tell the story all wrong. They don't explain it right. And of course, never the reasons why, never the context, none of those things. And fingers point the wrong way. I'm also appalled at the eulogizing of a U.S. ambassador and 3 U.S. employees. Every death is tragic, and it should be mourned for what it is. Although Christopher Stevens is no hero. He was Washington's point man with the transitional Libyan council that the puppet group installed. Now there's a puppet government. There was the puppet NTC before the puppet government with a puppet leader, multiple puppet leaders, and Lewis was the imperial point man in Libya. Well, it's tragic that he was killed. But what about, and I said this in a Press TV interview, what about the millions of Muslims who America has killed for over two decades? Just going back to the Gulf War in 1991, millions of them, the wars, the sanctions in Iraq, the daily deaths that go on that nobody even knows about or talks about or reports. What about those people, the nameless, faceless millions? Anybody mourning them? Anybody lowering flags in America to half-mast for all of these people? Well, they're human beings, just like Ambassador Stevens, just like the other three Americans. They're every bit as good, every bit as worthy. Their rights are every bit as important, and those are the things that matter to me, and you'll never hear word one about them when Obama vows revenge and Hillary Clinton comes out with her blather. I mean, this stuff just it lands in my stomach like a thud, Jim, and it just stays there with me overnight.
Well, I think we should go back and discuss the earlier point that you raised about the fact that many of these extremist Islamic gunmen were armed by the U.S. They were brought into the country by the U.S. They were financed by the U.S. U.S. airplanes bombed Gaddafi's army and allowed these thugs in Benghazi to flourish. I mean, they were on the verge of extinction, as most Libyans didn't want anything to do with them. Washington saved them from defeat and armed them and stimulated them and thought, you know, it's like a used condom. They thought after they screwed Gaddafi or killed him that these people would go away. And they haven't gone away because there's no government in that country. They call it election, but and nobody takes it serious. It doesn't have a reliable police force as existed under Gaddafi. The Ministry of Interior sat on his hands while they sacked the embassy. Their police force watched. They had a security guard against the council, and the account that we read is that they ran away when these attackers came because they agreed with them.
Oh, so I'm not surprised
about
that.
There's no army that no government that really governs the country. Everybody has their own political agenda. This is what the U.S. brought together, a conglomeration of clans and political gunmen and extremists, Al-Qaeda people, and then they thought out of this, Gaddafi falls and everything will disappear. All these groups will disarm, disappear, and join in an army in a government controlled by Washington. This is the height of naivete or cynicism, and now they're paying the cost of this tremendous opportunism.
And they're doing the same thing again in Syria right
now,
Jim.
Exactly, Steve.
Exactly. A duplicate. The only difference between Syria and Libya is NATO has not come in with their bombing campaign. But is it that far away? Who knows? Rasmussen, the head of NATO, says NATO will never get involved. Well, I don't believe that for a minute. I think the plans are all set to get involved one way or another. And, of course, the only way NATO can get involved is if the Security Council authorizes it. It didn't. They went through the back door on Libya with this no-fly zone. There really is a declaration of war, and a so-called safe haven on the ground is a no-fly zone on the ground. It's another declaration of war. So far, Russia and China haven't gone along with it. I can't imagine that they will, but who cares? 1999,
well, Steve, I'm glad you mentioned Syria, because when you look at the actual political and military composition of these invaders and terrorists that are attacking the government, the great bulk of the big terrorist incidents are by Al-Qaeda. The Al-Qaeda people have infiltrated Syria with the support of France, the so-called socialist government of France, the so-called conservative government of England, with the benign support of Germany, and of course Washington's deeply implicated, and these are the same people that blew up the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, and they will do the same after they destroy Syria, which is what they're doing. They're not trying to take over a country. They're destroying a country like they destroyed Iraq and they destroyed Afghanistan. And when you destroy an economy and a country and you divide it up into all these factions, are you going to have chaos? You're going to have people resorting to their clans and their families and their guns. And that's not the basis for forming a government, a stable government, nor will Washington be able to take any economic advantage of this situation, because actually, when you look at it, U.S. corporations did a hell of a lot of business with Gaddafi. They were doing business in Iraq and Syria. And after Washington backs these thugs, these factions, there's no business to be made. All you can say to Washington's credit is that they destroyed a government in order to impoverish their people.
Well, they sure have. And the same stuff is going on in Iraq, Jim. You know, the supposed disengagement. Two years ago now, I lose track of time. It was August, I think August 2010, when Obama declared his disengagement. Well, as far as I know, there are still 50,000 U.S. combat troops there, but there aren't too many reports, but there are car bombs going on going off around the country all the time. People are dying. Only the big ones occasionally get reported. These are the same characters that are causing all of the violence in Libya, all the violence in Syria. I mean, they're all over the place, and I don't know what they want in Iraq. The only thing I can figure out they want is an Islamic government, and for people who are unemployed, they want a job and a paycheck. I don't know what they're paying these people, or even if they're actually getting paid, what kind of a sales pitch they get to enlist them. But aside from establishing an Islamist government, what on earth do they want to go to war with an Arab country for? But they're doing it one after another. In Afghanistan in the 1980s, they wanted to get rid of the Russians, I guess, and they were paid for that. And well, they did that. The Russians finally wised up and left the country. America loves the wars that don't end, Jim. They're the ones that the profiteers love the most. So Afghanistan, America's longest war in history. My God, the way it's going, it could go on for another decade.
Well, I think it's draining the U.S. economy. These wars, these incidents, these conflicts, they're draining America. Trillions of dollars have been wasted in wars that the U.S. can't win, that don't produce any income. They're total losses as far as the economy goes. The U.S. doesn't pump out any wealth from these places. It just creates tremendous animosities, and they get rid of a leader, but they get rid of an adversary, but then they multiply the new set of adversaries. And I think the key here, Steve, is one of the old imperial tactics is divide and conquer, and that's what Washington did. It set the Shias against the Sunnis, the Kurds against the Arabs, and the Arabs against the Turkmen, etc. They thought they're very clever. They thought this is a really smart thing to do. And the legacy of that is a continuation afterwards, after they use off these people and different groups. Then they create mortal enemies. Look what the legacy in India. The Brits played the Muslims off against the Hindus, and 60 years later, those conflicts still fester. And so it creates a very conflictual environment. No businessman is going to go in when the Sunnis are putting bombs in downtown Baghdad, and when in Afghanistan, Hamzi Karzai, the president, has to have U.S. Marines for presidential guards because he doesn't trust anybody in his own army. I mean, this is the consequences of playing off groups against groups, arming everybody, and the result is they accomplish, in some cases, a short-term gain, but the legacy is a horrendous conflictual environment which is totally opposed to business and to economic growth.
Jim, I agree with you right down the line. We have a few minutes left. Can I change the subject?
Absolutely,
to one very important for me, and I think for you too. It's in the city I live in. It's in Chicago, and there's a teacher strike going on. I'd like to get your comments on it today, this morning. I'll get it out tomorrow, and you'll see it. I wrote my fifth article. I'm still writing it on the Chicago teacher strike, but I see capitulation. I can smell it, and I can taste it. And to me, aside from the rights that teachers have a right to have, decent pay and decent benefits and so on, decent working conditions, I think that the soul of Chicago is on the chopping block to either be lost or saved. And public education, to me, that is the bottom line in this struggle, where the mayor, Rahm Emanuel, a corporate predator, absolutely turned politician, he wants the schools privatized, made another profit center. You know, commodifying education. Education is a right. It's not a commodity to be sold to the highest bidder, and I think that's the bottom line issue in Chicago. Your comments on what's going on?
Well, I think he's closing down about 20% of all the public schools, forcing people to go into these charter schools. Now, the big picture for Rahm Emanuel is not being mayor of Chicago. He has bigger ambitions. He wants to be a senator. He wants to be a presidential candidate. And this is the way of ingratiating himself to Wall Street and the big investors that bankroll political campaigns. He's going to show everybody how he can smash unions. He can show how he can privatize the economy. He's going to show how he can cut back on the deficit at the cost of the people. In other words, he's establishing a reputation as someone that's willing to take a tough line on social issues so that he can be seen as a very strong candidate for national office. So I think he's playing to a Wall Street, a Chicago trading board audience here, and he's going to say, I did what the dailies couldn't do, and I'm a candidate for a bigger office because what I'm doing in Chicago is a microcosm of what I would do if I became president or senator in national office.
God help us, Jim. He really is a super rogue. I've written about him before. And
he's not even a full U.S. citizen. He's a 50% U.S. citizen. He's 50% Israeli citizen.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was a presidential advisor, he went to bat for Israel and got the U.S. engaged in extending and deepening its war against the Arab and Muslim countries. So he's got a reputation that will bring in funding from the pro-Israeli lobby. He's playing now. He's the big money bag. So everybody knows it. When Obama needs money, runs to Rahm Emanuel, who goes out and shakes down the people that benefit from his policies.
It's an ugly situation, Jim. We're out of time. I watched this thing, and very disturbing. It just bothers me.
I hope the Chicago strike results in some positive benefits because these people have put up a tremendous exemplary battle. I mean, they stand out in the desert of U.S. unionism. The Chicago teachers have stood up and said no to all these cutbacks.
I agree with you, Jim. I fear that the union's about to sell them out, and they want the kids back in classrooms on Monday.
Well, the union leaders may,
but the union bosses
on the picket line, I have another idea about this.
Oh, that's absolutely right. The union bosses, Karen Lewis, the CTU president. We're out of time, Jim.
Okay, Steve. we'll talk again.
Thank you,
Jim. Good luck. Bye.
Join us, of course, every Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on weekends, tomorrow and Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.